Today's program was brought to you by Domain. Domain offers discreet and secure storage, transportation, trading, and advisory services to passionate fine wine collectors worldwide. For more information, visit domainstorage.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and we are coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today on the show, we have the greatest sommelier in the world, and that is not just my opinion. That is a title that he has actually won in a competition that happens only once every 3 years, this year in Argentina. It is Arvid Rosengren. He is here in the studio. But before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that we do have a new time here Wednesdays at 11 a.m. so that I can eat delicious pizza at Roberta's after. And please listen to us live. And if you can't catch it live, you can always find back episodes on heritageradionetwork.org or iTunes or Stitcher or however you like to listen to podcasts. And when I'm not here hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Altalinea this summer. Altalinea is our outdoor restaurant in Chelsea in the Highline Hotel. It's on 20th. And 10th Avenue, and we are known for our frozen Negronis. They are delicious outdoors in the sun. Please join me for a frozen Negroni at Altalinea. All right, as I said, we have an exciting show today. The greatest sommelier in the world, a sommelier at my one of my absolute favorite restaurants here in New York City, Charlie Bird Restaurant. We have Arvid Rosengren in the studio. I am so excited. Huge congratulations to you on your
Thank you so much. I'm stoked to be here.
I think the all of the New York sommelier community was so happy for you. I know you have friends around the world who are cheering for you as well. Can you tell us about this this competition and the ASI? I know this year it happened in Argentina. How long have you been studying for it? What was this like?
Yeah, so I mean it's a long story. Just when I started out as a sommelier back in 2008, I worked with I was sharing the role of head sommelier in a restaurant with a guy who was going to compete in the Swedish competition. So that's where I'm from. We were working in Stockholm, Sweden, and I was like, oh, I think I can beat this guy. This is a little friendly rivalry going on. We were training together. I did beat him. I didn't win the competition that time. I won it the year after. But that sort of got me started on the path, and I've been on it ever since. So, I mean, competing as a sommelier is a pretty sort of niche, esoteric little thing. And I just want to get it out there, too, that calling yourself, I mean, I don't call myself the best sommelier in the world, mainly because it's such a subjective thing, and it's the best sommelier is whoever does a good job making his guests' experience better for the evening. So most of my favorite sommeliers in the world aren't competing. But for me, it was a good way to better myself. It was a good way for me to keep studying and keep tasting and keep pushing myself to a better result and more knowledge. Go ahead.
No, so you had to win these kind of feeder competitions first in order to qualify for this, right?
Right. So you have to be the represent your country in some capacity. So I won best sommelier in Sweden in 2010, best in Europe in 2013. I competed in the world that same year, which was in Tokyo. Did pretty well, but it didn't go all the way. And then so the competition, as you said, is every 3 years. And having won the European, I was directly qualified to compete again.
Wow, there's an Olympics even more frequently than this, right? The summer and the winter every 2 years. What did you find was the most difficult part of the studying?
I think as anyone who studied for any sort of certification, whether it's any of the competitions or the MS program, whatever, theory is taxing. It takes up so much time and effort. And as the world of wine is getting bigger and and with the wealth of information out there on the internet, and so the world of wine is so huge right now, and it takes so much time. I've spent thousands of hours studying up on esoteric grape varieties in Eastern Europe, or you know, Chinese wine, or stuff that you don't necessarily have any use of really in your daily work. But
what was your technique to study? I mean, do people still use index cards? It's been so long since I've studied for anything.
I used it in a very different way. I decided pretty early on this path that I was not going to be one of the people that won this thing at 50, having tried five times. I wanted to get in and get out, in a way. So I knew that I had to. I didn't have as much time as many other people have had who've won in the past. And I work pretty busy week, so I decided to study smart rather than just a lot.
I've been at Charlie Bird very late, and you've been there, and you are working the floor. You're working
hard,
and selling really good wine along the way.
I love it, so I'll hopefully never stop doing that. But yeah, studying for me was a very systematized process. Instead of just using like flashcards, you know, I've scoured through books and internet and put everything into a computerized system, basically like a flashcard system of lists and maps and stuff. So every day it sort of fed me back a number of questions and a number of... So I had like a theory test every morning. Every morning I wake up, sit down, have a coffee, and you know, I had a 200 question test in front of me pretty much. I laid that out pretty smart in a way that, you know, if there was something I was good at, and I repeatedly answered yes, and that got pushed so far in the future that I wouldn't see it. So I only had like the tough parts left in that sense.
And I know that, you know, at every night at Charlie Bird, there's some amazing wine that's being open. How did working at that restaurant kind of help you along with this?
I think that working in that restaurant and in that type of restaurant, which is what I've done for quite some time, I started out working in fine dining and sort of left that pretty early, much due to happenstance, but I really enjoy working in casual, fast-paced restaurants, and I think that gave me a real edge, considering that most people that I was... This is definitely the first time someone has won this competition who's not working in a full suit and polished shoes and
white tablecloth, right?
Absolutely. You know, the most of the people competing are from classic, you know, two-three-star Michelin restaurants, I work in jeans and sneakers and a rolled up shirt.
I think that marks a change in the way people are dining. I don't think that's just I don't know how you feel about this, but I don't think that's just a coincidence.
No, I definitely agree. I think that's not all of the future, but it's certainly a bigger part of going out and dining with a focus on wine. You see it in New York, but you also start to see it in places like Paris. Like, where do you want to go drink wine for people like us? That's one, like, where do you want to go when you're thinking about restaurants? You want to go dine, you want to go to a fun place and drink some good juice, and those restaurants are sort of taken over in a little bit.
I certainly do, and I'd rather pay for a nicer wine and not have the prices of the linen and chandeliers and flowers be incorporated into the bill.
Right, but to go back to your previous question, I think I really had an edge in that we do serve some of the greatest wines in the world, you know, old bottles, weird frail corks, you know, stuff that has to be handled very, very, very carefully. And I think we really excel at that at a place like Charlie Bird. But, you know, there's no time to roll up your guerdon and take the 5 minute ceremony. You might have six bottles to open in a 5 minute span. So you have to do everything correctly, but really fast paced and still have that sort of gentle touch with the guests. And I think that really helped me out once I got to the sort of competition stage, because it's all about, like, it's pretty fast paced once you're there. Yeah.
Maybe is the pace a little bit more slow in the competition actually, or are they still kind of pushing you forward?
They're pushing. Okay. They are. Yeah. I don't know if they're trying to make it a little bit of an audience sport. There's an audience watching the final at least. And this year they were live streaming it and stuff. So I think they're trying to make it a bit exciting. So they're definitely trying to push you, working effectively and then setting up some traps along the way too. So.
And did you have a New York-based study team? I think I heard that there's a couple people helping you out.
Yeah, I had the core of my team, it sounds like I have like a posse backing me up, but I had a good
Don't mess with a wine posse.
Yeah. No, they're serious. They're serious. I had a good team back home, but I also had some great help here. Some people like Michael Engelman and Pascaline Lepeltier and Aldo Somme, who's competed in the same kind of world, as have Michael and Pascaline, have been really, really instrumental in helping me out here and setting up tastings every week and, you know, tough practical tests. And, you know, I show up at 11 in the morning at the Modern with Michael, and he makes me do blind tasting for staff lineup, you know, just out of the blue, before lunch service at the Modern. Stuff like that has been great in just getting me ready to do this. So I'm really thankful for all the help.
And was there any topic that you really felt like you just couldn't, like it was just something that was a thorn in your side and you couldn't master it?
You mean leading up to the competition?
Leading up to the competition. Like, oh, I need to spend some more time on this because I can't figure this out.
For some reason, I had a really tough time with some spirits blind tasting, which Aldo put me through. And it's so, like, every other time, he put up some different pisco's and stuff. And every other time, I'd nail it. And every other time, I'd be, like, so lost. And there was no, like, reason to anything. So that was tricky. And, you know, you're battling against time. There's never enough time to do everything you want.
Right, of course. The world of wine is getting just bigger and bigger.
Right, right.
There's so many new regions that are coming out, and there's so much more information.
Yeah, and you're studying spirits and beer and cheese and chocolate and coffee and tea and everything as well. Of course, wine is the biggest part, but it's a broad... It's getting to become very broad at this point.
Yeah. It's amazing. Now, I mean, now that you've accomplished this, are you going to take a break from studying?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'll sort of stay caught up with the world of wine, and I really enjoy learning about new things as well. I think there's so much exciting things happening on sort of the outskirts of the world of wine, but I could see myself delving deeper into the wine regions that I like really enjoy drinking too, you know.
Yeah, because there had to be something of you know, you have to learn. Maybe it's Chinese wines or something that is, not to say anything bad about Chinese wines. I haven't had enough to make a good opinion, but you had to perhaps taste and be expert in wines that you just don't care as much about.
Right, especially like you say, some there's always. There are always a number of questions on stuff like that. Eastern Europe, Asia, Northern Africa. Things that are maybe not super relevant. I mean, it's good that they're sort of promoting them in an indirect way, forcing people to at least sort of try to learn about these wines. But there's not enough of the actual wine on export markets to taste and to evaluate. But yeah, unfortunately... As these things become sort of tougher and tougher, and as people become more sort of proficient in how to study, and they have to push it in sort of an esoteric direction.
Did you find yourself when you were going out to eat? Because I think that this is what I would do. I would order the wine by the glass that I'm least familiar with, just so I knew that, you know, I could be
all the time,
right?
I'd be the idiot ordering three glasses just as an aperitif, and then ordering a bottle of wine, like pushing those aside.
You know, order the bottle of wine so it's something you actually wanted.
Yeah.
All right. That is Arvid. We are just going to take a very quick break. We'll be back with more. I think you are the best sommelier in the world.
Thank you. I'm happy that
you're here in New York for now. But come visit Arvid at Charlie Bird, and we'll be back with a quick break here on In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Domain offers discreet and secure storage, transportation, trading, and advisory services to passionate fine wine collectors worldwide. Since 2003, they've focused on making collecting easier and more enjoyable. With over 1.5 million bottles in storage across five facilities, Domain is the largest network of wine storage warehouses in the country. Warehouses are located in Chicago, St. Louis, Metro New York, Napa, and Washington, D.C., with refrigerated shipment hubs in dozens of cities. Their service also extends to the home collector. In the last decade, the team has organized and inventoried more than 1.7 million bottles in home sellers across the globe. Recently, Domain has launched a marketplace where clients can buy and sell wine. Trading in the network ensures that wines are stored at Domain facilities and commissions are the lowest in the industry. Go to domainstorage.com to complete an online questionnaire and someone will get back to you within one business day.
All right, we are back on In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and we are coming to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick. And just as a reminder, we are here with Arvid Rosengren, sommelier at Charlie Bird Restaurant and the recent winner of the ASI, the Best Sommelier in the World competition. This is a big media day for Arvid. We actually have a team from CBS This Morning who's shooting both inside of the studio, and now they're looking at us from outside. We should give them a quick wave. Hey, guys. After this, Arvid has actually told me he's headed straight to the New York Times, where he's going to be on a tasting panel. Tell us about what tasting panel you're doing today.
I'm tasting Galician whites, primarily Godeo-based wines, I think, which is something I've been raving about for several years. So this is actually a pretty fun tasting panel. It should be
cool. Yeah. I like Godeo a lot, but I wish I knew more about it. But what has drawn you to Godeo?
I used to go to that sort of part of Spain once or twice a year, primarily to the Basque Country. Mm-hmm. It was easier when I lived in Europe, but that was my like vacation spot for 5 years in a row, I think. But then I started sort of branching out. I went to Galicia, and I just found the wines to be super interesting, and like the potential so high, not just with Godeo, but that's the most obvious example. That's mm-hmm. the variety that's gotten furthest. To me, it's one of the most dynamic wine regions in the world right now, like along with, you know, a place like Greece and stuff. But Galicia in particular, the wines are so like gastronomically useful and fresh, right, and different from everything that's grown in Spain. People have this like preconceived notion of Spanish wine being like big, heavy red wine usually. And these wines are just fresh and light and lively and mineral.
Just really drinkable, right?
Super drinkable.
There's something about coastal white wines that I love, I'm drawn to. And
absolutely,
you see that there too.
Yeah.
You see that there. So you spent most of your life in Europe and have recently moved to the States. Can you tell us the story about how we got you here?
Right. Yeah. So I was, as I said before, I started out working in Sweden, in Stockholm, but I'm originally from the very south of Sweden. So my sort of closest hub was Copenhagen in Denmark. And I left Stockholm after a little over a year working, and I went to Copenhagen, where I spent working 6 years. I originally went down there to work for a fine dining restaurant, a place that just now got their third star a couple of weeks ago. But in their first iteration, they sort of, this was right after the financial crisis, so they went bankrupt, closed for a while. So I found another job and started working for a steakhouse that was just opening, owned by some really competent people, all like sommeliers and chefs, who opened what was the first sort of exclusive steakhouse in that part of the world. Steakhouse were normally like a budget type affair, mm-hmm. But they ordered, you know, they opened with that American exclusive mindset, and this became a huge success. I mean, originally for me it was like, I'm going to be here for a couple of months or whatever, ride it out until I can find a new job. But I ended up, that was my first like real casual wine job in that way, and I ended up selling so many great bottles. I was like, I'm never going to go back to selling wine you know, pairing menus. I'm selling great bottles of wine here every night. This is insane.
There's something energizing and exciting about selling a really great bottle of wine.
Yeah. And I had nights there where I was just putting away, like, you know, glass after glass, a little tasting glass on the little shelf, to the point where I at the end, like, wasn't sure what was what. It was, you know, so many cool bottles of wine. This ended up becoming a huge success. And this went from one restaurant to, I moved around in the group and opened a restaurant for them. This other, like, worked at their Japanese concept, they also have a classic French brasserie, all with a great wine list. So I ended up being the wine director for this group of eight restaurants. In the end of 2014, they were going to open three more restaurants in 2015 in three different countries. And I was 29, and at the time I was, you know, kind of off the floor, stuck behind a computer, answering 200 emails a day and looking at spreadsheets all the time. I was, like, stressed and bored at the same time. So I even though it was a great job, I had fantastic buying power and traveled around the world, met winemakers, did blends. So, you know, I had some great contacts in the winemaking world from this gig. It sort of outgrew me, and I knew I had to get back to the floor. You know, I had to get back to serving bottles and talking to people. So I was looking for something else, and looking pretty, not globally, but I was looking at some different cities around the world. New York was not one of them. I never really had any connection here in that sense. Mm-hmm.
Had you been to New York before?
No, not before. Never. It's actually pretty funny. I've traveled a bunch to the West Coast, but never to New York. So anyways, I was looking at other places, And I happened to be traveling with a little fun group of winemakers, a couple of French winemakers that I was meeting with in Copenhagen. We were doing a bunch of, like, tastings and a little sort of gastronomical tour. And we went up to Stockholm and met with Roche Parr and Pierre Ingis of Chakra and Robert Bohr, who I now work with. And so, of course, I was, like, sort of telling them what was happening in my life, and they were like, you know, forget about going to London or wherever else you think you're going. You should go to New York. And I spoke at length with Robert and our sort of philosophy on how, you know, hospitality is supposed to be done really, really clicked. So I distinctly remember we were up in at Faviken, you know, this at this point sort of legendary restaurant in very rural Sweden. I remember calling my girlfriend, being, hey, you know, we've talked about moving, you know, to maybe Stockholm or maybe London or whatever, but how do you feel about New York? And she was like, sure, let's do it.
Wow, great.
And so this happened, you know, within, you know, I've traveled over here a couple of weeks later and saw what was going on, and then came here for the Paulé and spent a week working at Charlie Bird during that crazy mad Paulé week, and then moved over here a month later, pretty much. Yeah,
and has the New York wine scene been kind of open and embracing? What do you
from
think?
From day one? From day one, I've never met a community that is so sort of welcoming and ambitious in a good way, just full of such dedicated but still friendly and like open minded people. It's been fantastic to become part of it from day one. Everyone was like, come on in, let's do it.
And do you find there to be any difference between New York wine drinkers and wine drinkers from back home or from,
yeah,
like,
yeah, definitely. I think there's an open-mindedness in both ways. I do think that the New York wine drinkers are very, or American wine drinkers in general, are pretty well educated. Of course, not everyone, but the ones, you know, you certainly run into people who have their thing and they've tasted, you know, every wine Christophe Roumier has ever made. They've gone there and done harvests. They might not know, so they might not have like a holistic perspective on everything in the world of wine, or know anything outside of their little niche, but they're super educated on that. And people, one thing I like more than anything is that people seem to have, as a general rule, seem to have more fun ordering and drinking wine here. People are a little bit more sort of, whatever, let's give it a try and, you know, see what happens. And not as much sort of prejudice in terms of wine, which is great.
All right. Yeah. I'm happy to hear that. And you know, I find that intimidating too sometimes, where some of our guests will be, maybe they're a partner at a law firm right? And they are the best in their field in a law firm, but also they know more about Riesling than I do. Like, wait a second. How can you also like be, you know, that dialed in? But I guess like they're them being so good at their other job will allow them to take their passion that, you know, that far, that far as well. Cool. I've only worked in restaurants in New York. So, I find that guests are pretty open-minded and have become more open-minded. I mean, they're more so today than they were 10 years ago.
And of course, you still run into people at Charlie Bird who are like, where's the Napa cab section? Like, it isn't there. but it happens less and less, often. It feels like most, you know, 99% of people are pretty happy to try almost whatever. And, you know, are getting better at describing what they like in terms of wine too.
Yeah, and I know that Charlie Bird has just outstanding French wines, really known for the French wines, but wines from other places in the world as well. What else is selling that is not great Burgundy or Champagne?
Yeah, I mean, Italy is always strong, yes, and it's always going to be strong, I think, in a city like New York. And you know, to be honest, too, the wines are getting better. Not as a general, you know, no, as a general rule, the wines are getting better. There have always been like high points of Italy, but it might be sort of saturation in the New York wine market as well. I hadn't tasted much like good Ligurian wine before I came to New York. I hadn't tasted much good Sardinian wine either, for that matter. Like, it might be a change in the general sort of quality of the wines, but also might be that the best wines end up here.
Yeah. Or maybe the importers are particularly interested in that. But I love Ligurian wines.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think that other places don't have as good
Ligurian. But I've been to Liguria. The wines you find are not that great on the average wine list or wine stores. They're like, ooh.
Yeah. They're super simple. Though, if you are in Liguria, you know, eating some frutti di mare or something on the coast with some pesto and focaccia, and you have a simple white wine, it's not the worst thing
That's true.
It's not the worst. So what is next for you? I know you have some travel coming up. Do you have year looking at?
So right now I'm just trying to sort of find a little bit more of a relaxed everyday, I guess. I think there are some people in my close vicinity, like family and my girlfriend, et cetera, who would love that. But we'll see. I'm super happy being where I am. I think that there will definitely be some cool sort of gigs and things coming up on sort of a consulting side of things. There'll definitely be some more travel and sort of doing tastings and stuff like that. But I think I will always have at least one foot in the restaurant world, if not two. I love working in a restaurant. I thought about this yesterday. I had a super stressful day, and then as soon as service starts, it's like some sort of weird meditation. There's nothing else you can do but be there and be present, and it's fantastic.
Doesn't matter what emails you have, you put that all away.
Can't do anything about it.
Do it tomorrow morning. Yeah. And you always say, "Sorry, I was in service." Like, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And now, you know, once you start, you know, going back to doing some sort of reading and that sort of thing, what will you continue to read in the wine world for education? I mean, for both education, but also for like just pure pleasure. Mm.
I think, you know, there's one thing that's become more evident, like the more I learn, is that I really know very little in a way about some sort of very fundamental things. I think this is true for most sort of wine lovers and drinkers. Like, still, things like explaining terroir and soils and stuff like that is tricky, and how it influences wine. It's something we all sort of rattle off, but I for one, for sure, don't understand it in a fundamental way. I'd love to read up more about like the wines of, you know, Montalcino or the Rhone Valley, which I know the wines, but I'm not, I don't always understand why the difference is in the wines is what it is. You know, I like to dig deeper into those kind of things that I really love.
Yeah, and I find that a lot of times it's going to those regions multiple times, right? Mm-hmm. Like after you've gone back a few times, then you start to really understand them, because you can only read so much in the book. And you think that, you know, if you have a certain way of making wine, that will the grape and the terroir will affect it in, you know, some places the terroir is stronger, some places the grape is, some places the winemaking is. And then when those three come together, it's hard to say.
Mm.
All right, we are going to wrap up, but I would encourage everyone to go visit Arvid, tell him congratulations, drink outstanding wine, and be open-minded when you do it over at Charlie Bird. I am so happy you came on the show. Thank you so much, Arvid.
Thank you. Thank you.
Huge congratulations. I wanted to thank everyone here for listening. Thanks to Domain for sponsoring the show. You guys are the best. Thanks to David, Aaron, Jack, and everyone at Heritage Radio. And we'll look forward to seeing this on CBS this morning in a few weeks. All right. Thanks, guys. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.